Yeah, I mean, I'm really feeling validated by something so much greater than we are. Every time something happens in this room that feels sort of unexpected for me, I get that. I just get that way that my prayer this morning was like, I know whatever Spirit imagines for us is greater than I, as the leading minister, as I could come up with on my own. And I think that you just demonstrated that right behind, right after Jane's prayer. Where'd you go, Jane? Oh, my goodness. What a gorgeous, gorgeous start for a fabulous morning and a great weekend in the West Valley. So good morning. I am Reverend Karen Rice, and I am indeed the spiritual leader of this community, and it is my great privilege to be here speaking to you on Father's Day. And we have a lot of people that are traveling and celebrating Father's Day, and we've got some other stuff going on. And I really, for a moment, I had so many calls between last night and this morning, thought that I might be running the whole act by myself. And I was really okay with that. So my treatment this morning when I, oh, and by the way, and then I overslept by an hour this morning. Didn't charge my phone and apparently didn't hear the alarm. I don't know, somehow it was just dead by morning. And when I opened my eyes and the sun was out, I went, oh my. I actually can't tell you the word I said. But it was alarming. It woke me up. And so I stopped. You know, I stopped and I thought, I am not going to hurry through this. I am not going to panic because everybody is gone. I even thought Clyde was on the road this weekend. So thank you, Reverend Clyde, for being here. And then I did a treatment because that's what we do. That's what we teach. That's our practice. And I just treated to know that this is okay, that everything will unfold perfectly, and that in the mind of God, it is already a great success, because how could it not be? So, and it helped me to have great confidence knowing you were going to be here, because I knew you would help things go smoothly. I wasn't sure how everybody was going to get in the building, but see, it all worked out. I surrendered that instead of worrying about it, and I got myself prepared in a perfect way. So we're going to have a good experience this morning. Well, we already have had a good experience this morning. Really beautiful. It's like watching you continue to grow. And hasn't it been fun to watch Kathy's husband, Rodney, get excited about being here? And really, what the level of what you're doing now for us is like so different. You used to just be in the shadow, you know, letting her sing. And now it's like he's performing, right? He's really letting his artist heart show. So And then you get better because somehow you've got that chemistry, right? You get better. So it's just been nothing but pure joy for us. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So happy Father's Day to all of you dads and to those of you moms who raised children on your own. You know, it takes that father energy to make decent human beings. And so we're so really grateful for this day where we can celebrate and honor you. And thanks for giving up or sharing your Father's Day experience with us. I hope you'll treat him to something later in the day. Were you going to make dinner for him or something or take him out? Yeah, good, 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 good. So I am looking today at this topic that says, you are not your job. And by the way, the subheading for that is, you are also not your retirement. Because we have a little bit of that going on as well. And we're following in this theme of accountability. And what I realize is, in terms of your job, I think that our job and what we really need to be accountable for in terms of our job is that we know who we are and that we recognize this idea of creative expression, which we are gifted at. We always have that opportunity to express creatively, which we are born to do. We are made to express creatively in our lives. It is the way we tap into that divine imagination and create things in our own lives. And that really is an essence of who we are. So we're going to have a good conversation. I have lots to say about it, and it didn't go in the direction I expected it was going to go. I think it turned out a little even more fun and a little better. So I wanted to start by saying because it's Father's Day, that I also, like Clyde, had I was really blessed with having a lovely role model for a father. And my dad was a plasterer. He was in construction, and so he had that ability to like fix anything that was broken. But more than that, he was extremely creative and resourceful, to where he would save little silly things because he had this sense of knowing he'd be able to make something out of it later, or that he could be creative. So Daddy was really creative, and as a little girl, I do remember thinking he could do anything. And so I see how sometimes we sort of put that idea of God, especially if you think about a personified God, an anthropomorphic image of the divine, you could see that we kind of, as kids, sometimes expect that on our parents, and well, a lot of things could go wrong with that expectation. What I would say is, I know that my dad was really excellent at doing. You know, he was busy. I take after my dad more than my mom. My mom was really good at being. I would say that being never came natural for me. In fact, in order for me to be, I had to like figure out a way to get it on my to-do list so that I could find a way to balance that out. And I'll tell you something, I don't think I fully understood what it meant to just be until I started studying meditation. And it kind of snuck up on me. I'm not sure I would have been open-minded enough to have a meditation practice, because I had such a beautiful experience as a fundamental Christian. And that was in the 70s and the early 80s when I was participating in that type of Christian worship. And in the 70s, because of transcendental meditation, TM, you know, that there was this, from a Christian perspective, there was this, it was a taboo to think about meditating, because you don't want to empty your mind, because that's when the demons will jump in and you know, and confuse you. So I'm not sure I would have been open to a stillness, a sitting practice, or sitting still, or meditation as a part of my spiritual practice, except that I took this college class that some of you have heard me tell this story before. I was studying, I was a psych major, and I took a class called Personal and Social Adjustment, and on one of the weeks, the lesson was solitude. I promise you, I could not even pronounce that term for many years, even after I was exposed to it, because it was so foreign to my life. What does it mean to be still, to have some solitude, peace in your life, and quiet instead of busy doing all the time? Because I get that. You know, I inherited that great, I'm also resourceful, but I'm good at being busy. So I took this class, and we had this assignment where we had to go sit out on the, you know, you hurry up to get to school, and then we had to leave the classroom and go sit for a half an hour somewhere on the campus and not talk to anybody else, and then come back and write about it and talk about what that experience was like. And what happened for me was that it became a life-changing experience. As the longer I sat, the more I began to realize that there was a way in which it feels good. Now, of course, it was an assignment, and I was a good student. I did what the teachers wanted, so that I think that really helped. But that then that opened me to be curious about a meditation practice, and so I moved forward with that. So if you're like me and you're busy, and it seems difficult to meditate, which it no longer does for me because I've been now have had a meditation practice for a long time, but you might follow my suggestion and just put it on your to-do list, because then you can check it off. And for a busy person, nothing's more fun than checking off those things that we get done. So for some of us, sitting still is hard. Thomas Merton, a wonderful Trappist monk, a Catholic priest who was also a mystic and wrote prolifically. He's been published a lot, and I fell in love with him early on this path. I think what appeal he had for me was that he is very involved in comparative religions, and I became interested in those things too at a certain point in my life. And so Thomas Merton said this: For some, nothing is more difficult than to sit still and rest, doing nothing at all. The very act of resting is the hardest and the most courageous act to be performed, and often it is quite beyond their power. Isn't that interesting? That the act of sitting still is not only hard, but for some it is actually a courageous thing to do because we find it beyond our power. And this is where I think the spiritual path is so inviting, because it gets us into a place where we recognize those things that take courage are sourced from something beyond our own power, that we can tap into something in a universal way that is greater than we are, and that something for us on the spiritual path is God, or that infinite intelligence, spirit itself. So I guess you could say, I learned to be courageous in my ability to sit still, and certainly in the early days, that's an appropriate word for it. But I think the beautiful thing that happens when we do find comfort in sitting quietly is that we begin to really sense who we are. And I think we begin to see that it is not our job. So much of who we believe ourselves to be is about our identity in this physical world. Our job, our career, our education, or even our roles. Those roles we have in relationship to each other. So I am a mother, a wife, a sister, I'm a daughter. And then all of that begins to grow. We are neighbors. And so we have multiple relationships ongoing, because that's the nature of life. And it's easy to think that that's who we are. One of the startling things that happens to people when they retire sometimes is that they, especially if they're retiring from a long-term career, is that you sort of get lost in that way that you no longer identify yourself with that career. You don't know who you are. Or mothers who have dedicated their lives to parenting, to raising children. Then the children get old, and they, if we do a good job, Kathy, they will move out. They won't stay there. If we do a good job. And then there's that experience for some of us that we call, it even has a name, the empty nest. But that's because we have made that, we have identified so much with those roles that we think that's who we are. But it is not who we are. So, who are you? Don't answer, just think. Who are you? Indeed, our work, whether it's a parent or a career or parenting or a career, it doesn't matter. It is an avenue for us to have this gorgeous experience of creative expression, as I've mentioned. But then what happens if you're a devoted wife and you get divorced? What happens if you lose a job and it wasn't your choice to lose the job, right? So these things send us a little topsy-turvy, because we are not as clear as we can be about who it is that we are. Now, we would say, Reverend Cheryl is saying right now under her breath, well, I know who we are. We are individualized expressions of God. Right? Right? And so I wanted to talk about that, because we say that so often here. We are individualized expressions of God. So what does that mean? Yeah, what does that mean? Well, we'll look at that. I wanted to tell you that when Ernest Holmes was speaking about this idea of who we are, he had some fabulous responses, and so I have several passages from Holmes this morning that I'm going to share. But Holmes would always talk about this idea of oneness, that there's this macrocosm. I'm going to use these words because I'm going to talk about them in a minute. There's this macrocosm that is the universe, that is God, and that we are a part of it. We're not the whole thing. We are considered the microcosm of the macrocosm. So here's what Holmes has to say about this. This quote was taken from the Beverly Hills Lectures. By the way, all the quotes I'm using from Holmes today are from some of my favorite books that he holds his precious words. Our whole theory is that every person individualizes God. The cosmic self, the macrocosm, the whole, the cosmic self, capital S, manifests as the individual self, as us in an individual expression. The two selves are one. I am that which thou art, and thou art that which I am. And our point of contact with God is always at the center of our own being. So now he has dived deep in speaking to this idea of oneness and that we are individualized in the way that we come to the planet and have a body and we have relationships and we have a personality and we look different than each other and we act different than each other. We're so individual that there are no two humans that have the same fingerprints, thumbprints and fingerprints, that we're all that much different. But not only that, but that no two blades of grass are the same. That no two feathers on a bird or feathers, period, are the same. That no two grains of sand are exactly identical. Wow. That's a lot of individualization in this universe. We can't even really fathom what all of that means. And I would say that as we look at that idea where he said at the end, the point of contact with God is always at the center of your own being, not at the center of your doing. So certainly God is there, but that is not the way we have that oneness. It is the way when we are unique and we honor our uniqueness and that we are really different from each other, and instead of making differences separate us, when we are able to see our alikeness in spite of our differences, there's a big one that we could really put some attention on right now in June of 2017 to help make this world a better place. When we are able to do that, honor our uniqueness while at the same time seeing that we are absolutely connected to each other and to the greater whole, that is when we really begin to create a place where we can ponder who we are or what we are. See, Jesus understood this. I think that it's such a beautiful example of someone who came to this planet at a crucial time with a very unique message, and he was saying, the Father and I are one. The Father and I are one, and I do all this work. I can perform these. I can raise the dead and heal the sick because I get that. I understand the oneness. I understand the wholeness of life. And yet, as time went on, and they made a religion out of the life that Jesus lived, they sort of took that off in a different direction, and we have lost a big part of what he's saying, that we are, he is the elder brother, that we are created just, we are sons and daughters of the divine just as Jesus was, so we too can say the Creator and I are one. And also, when incredible things happen, which a lot of incredible things have unfolded before my eyes in the last 7 to 10 days, I want to tell you, I've witnessed some gorgeous evidence of the presence of God. Then we can also say that we really understand, it is not me, as Jesus said this, it's not me, but it is the Father within that does this, that there is a power that's greater than we are, and that we are here to allow that, the fullness of that power and the glory of that expression to just move through us. I was thinking while Jane was praying, nobody prays like Jane, right? Right? And it's an awfully good thing because it would be, you know, though it would be nice to have you up here every week, we need the variety because we're all different, right? So we create our attempt as leadership of a spiritual community is to give you lots of voices so that every so often there'll be a voice that just speaks to you. And Holmes understood that, and Jesus understood that. We are all individual expressions of the divine, and we express differently for all those reasons. Holmes also said this, everything in the universe is a unique individualization or an expression of the one thing that is the cause of all things. This means, wait for it, wait for it. This is my favorite quote of the day. This means that the ultimate cause, or God, or the universe, or spirit, whatever you want to call it, that infinite intelligence, this means that that ultimate cause, God, is pressing against every individual, and wait for it, here's the best part. And that means that every event in the finite has an infinite possibility behind it. Let me hear a big amen. All right, so everything is a unique expression of that one. And then that cause that we call God is the first cause, the ultimate cause, is pressing against us. That's why sometimes we call that an urge. You know, you get inspired to play music or to use your voice or to write a poem or to show up and just be that place on a Sunday morning where you sit in sanctuary and spirit moves through you and you feel that inspiration. You come to life and you feel it, and you can feel it moving through you. You can feel it vibrating in the walls of the sanctuary or from the floor. That is when we are absolutely there. And then he throws in this gorgeous line that says, every event, every experience, every condition in the finite that happens while we're living in our physical form has an infinite possibility behind it. That's what I mean when I say God's imagination is so much greater than mine, that I can think and I can name and I can call things into being because I know how to work the law, but I can work it even more when I get out of my own way and I really recognize who I am as more than Karen, the preacher, the mother, the wife, all the things I love in life. When I get out of all of that and I allow spirit to inspire me, then greater things happen. I can find a quote like that when I'm not even looking for it. I can show up somewhere and I can know just what to say, even if it doesn't feel like the right thing to say, and spirit will use me. Because for a moment, somewhere in there, I know who I am, and I get out of the way and I let that which is greater than me, I let that divine imagination that is bigger, because I'm willing to realize I am blessed, I am inspired, and therefore I am grateful for that potential. And then that potential swells. It grows, it increases, and it presses upon us with an urgency to be expressed in finite form. And you know the best part? We don't have to do anything to earn that. We don't have to do a thing to earn that. We just have to have a moment to remember the truth. So, again, don't answer, but who are you? Who are you? And I look at that word are. You know what happens when somebody asks you that question? Then we turn that around and we begin to answer. And how do you answer that? You begin with two words. Who are you? I am. And that's where all the action is. It's in the being. Amming is being. Are-ing is being. It's not in doing. You know, I was doing all of this and thinking so intently about it, and I realized that in different regions of the world and in different cultures, words have different meaning, especially when you look at greetings. And I thought a lot about that because Hugh and I lived abroad for almost a year. And we had some startling, beautiful, fresh experiences of living in other cultures. And I looked and I saw that in a war-torn region, it is common that the greeting, that the standard way you would greet each other is to say peace, shalom, peace be with you. In the countries of Burma and Cambodia, and Burma is now Myanmar, right? Did I say that right, honey? It's Myanmar. Burma is now Myanmar. Burma and Cambodia, the way they greet each other is they say, "Have you eaten today? Have you eaten today?" And in the most literal interpretation of that, they say, "Have you eaten rice today?" Isn't that lovely? In places where I would say what it means is that in regions where there is scarcity, they have that as their first concern. So I know.
Like shalom.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I bet you could Google it. The boys, get on it. Google it. In Java, they say, "Where are you going?" And the response to "Where are you going?" is "Over there." Isn't that cute? So you could say in a very formal way, the British would say, and we do this sometimes too, "How do you do? How do you do?" Well, now we're not being anymore at all, right? In fact, there's a lot of doing in several of those expressions. And in most commonly in the West, in our part of the world, we will say, "How are you?" We'll say, "How are you?" And you're really not inquiring to hear a list of somebody's ailments, but sometimes that's what happens when you ask, "How are you?" And it's funny, it's just as odd to me that the answer to that is, the proper answer to "How are you?" is "Fine." I don't know what that means. So as we look at that, we see that how we use our words is interesting, and that often these greetings have become idioms that don't really mean what they once intended to mean, but they're lovely customs. I love to hear the literal stuff behind stuff. We were having Chinese the other night, and this little gal that waits on, and she's really little, I don't mean it in a derogatory way, but she waits on us a lot, and we adore her, and she came up, and I said, "Hi, we're already eating." She's checking to see if we're enjoying our food. "Yes." And she says, and I said to her, "How are you?" As caring as I could, because I really am fond of her. And she went, "Oh, I'm so tired. I'm tired all the time. I'm tired." And I'm sitting there going, "I really don't know what to say to that, you know." So I said to her, "Well, tell me what you would be doing if you were at home right now and feeling this tired." And she said, "Oh," and she lit up. Now she lights up, and she says, "I would be at home, and I would be in bed, and I would be watching TV." And then I said, "Oh, tell me what you watch on TV." And then I had her engaged in conversation. So there's a way we can move beyond what becomes the idiom or the cliched way that we greet each other. But what I just find most interesting is the way we have attached meaning to words that no longer have the same meaning in the same way in which we ask the question, "Who are you?" You know, and we're also asked sometimes, and you've all had this happen, you're getting to know somebody for the first time, and they'll say, instead of "Who are you?" they'll say, "So what do you do?" Right? And they want to hear about your background, your occupation, or whatever. So what do you do? And I'm guilty of asking that question because I like to get to know people, and I'm looking for a place where we can have a conversation together, you know, where we can connect. I was on an airplane once, kind of on the beginning of this path for me. I was in a real transitionary place in my life. And it was one of those airplane seats. I don't even think they do it anymore. It was Friends Fly Free on Southwest, and a friend invited me. And so there was a row of seats right behind the, what do you call it? Yes, the bulkhead. And so this man was facing me. It was rather awkward. And so we were sitting here, the two of us, and then he was there with his son or something, and we exchanged names, and we got to know each other, and he said to me, "So what do you do?" And there was this long, awkward silence on my part because I thought, gosh, I don't know what I do anymore. My life is changing in like every way I could imagine. But that led us to a gorgeous conversation about how do you answer that question? You know, what is the other person really asking, and what needs to be said, what's called to be said here. So this morning, I was thinking a lot about all of this as I was getting ready to come over here. If I'm not my job, if I'm not my retirement, which I don't relate to at all yet, but you know, who or what am I? Who or what am I? And I think there's such a beautiful invitation in the question for us to examine ourselves and our own beliefs around ourselves. And I think for some of us, it gets sticky to do that because we then have some old beliefs that imply we might be conceited if we were thinking about such matters. But I've been listening to T.D. Jakes. I love T.D. Jakes. Anybody else willing to confess they listen to T.D. Jakes? Oh, I see, I'm a little surprised by a couple of those hands. So if you don't know who he is, he's this big, I think he's probably Baptist, this really rowdy, big man, and he's bald, and he really gets into it, and he has these wonderful women speak sometimes that are, they make me look sleepy, they're so alive. And I love to just be fed myself, and T.D. Jakes really does it for me, some days, not always. Sometimes he's a little too religious for me, but he was talking in the last one I listened to about the problem of low self-esteem. And he said the people that have low self-esteem typically look for crowd esteem. In other words, if you don't feel good about yourself, you're always going to be looking outside of yourself to be validated. And I think that's really important because you really can't have esteem if you don't start with yourself. And that's what I'm here to sort of repeat today. Let me share another quote with you from Ernest Holmes regarding who you are. Ready to hear one more? All right. You are a child of God. Ernest Holmes from Basic Ideas of Science and Mind. Dora, you should see if we don't have that, let's order some more. Fabulous little book. Basic Ideas of Science and Mind. He says, you are a child of God, and therefore you should have a high opinion of yourself. Yeah. Right? All right? Now, no, not foolish self-conceit, but a reverent understanding of your wondrous relationship with God. Tell yourself over and over again, there is a quality of love that lies within you, and it is only natural for you to be expressing it. Over and over again, tell yourself, there is a quality of love in me, and it is only natural that I express it, that I share it, that I give it. It is necessary to have a high opinion of yourself in a reverent way that you appreciate that wondrous relationship you have with God as an individualized expression of God. Then there's this one more funny thing I thought of. So I don't think I did this to my kids. I probably did. But I'm pretty sure I didn't do this to my kids. I probably did. But my mom used to do it to me all the time, and I'm just going to tell you, I know I earned it. So I'd do something that would upset her, and she would look at me with her hands on her hips, and she'd get real close to me, and she would get her finger. Oh, that finger still scares me when I think about it. And she would put it right in my face and go, who do you think you are? Right? So what is it about that? It's almost as if we use it against each other. It's like, I'm a kid. You know, it's like, well, I don't know. Apparently, I have pretty good self-esteem. I'm standing here. We're not running from that finger, you know? I know who I am. I can take this. And I was probably standing up for some cause that I felt was important to me because that's kind of how I've lived my life. So it seems to imply, well, you're not all that you think you are. And maybe that's a good point, because we're not all that. We're more. And we're something completely different than all that, whatever warrants that. So here's what I wanted to say this morning, and that is, when I ask you, who are you? Who do you think you are, even? We could soften it. Don't be quick to come up with an answer. Now, I already know what Reverend Cheryl was thinking because I can read her mind. And I already know that, I almost said Reverend Mark, how funny. And I already know what, I can guess that Mark was thinking something like, well, may I? I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. Yes? Oh, he's nodding. Because a whole bunch of you, that's because we say that so much. A whole bunch of us think that. But I want you to think of that in the same way that those greetings have changed in their meaning. Did you find out how to say that, by the way?
Well, I'll play it for you.
Okay. All right, because it's too hard to say, right? I know. That's why I didn't even Google that phrase, because I understand. I know, I lived in Thailand. I know anything from Cambodia or Myanmar is going to be hard to say. So the point is that I think the question invites us to have some space in our life. It is true we are a spiritual being having a human experience. It's absolutely true. We are an individualized expression of God. But when we are quick to have those answers, we miss the spaciousness that calls us to have an experience of what that means. So I want to invite you, in fact, I'm going to say this is your homework assignment, to create some space this week to ponder who you are. Because I can't tell you an answer that you'll be able to intellectually respond, but I want this to be a full experience of us moving deeper. And here's the truth. In order to understand who you truly are, there needs to be that, emptiness that is a vulnerability. In other words, I am willing to set aside for a brief while who and what I think I am, to explore the possibility of the greater vision that God would say as to who and what I am. When they asked the Buddha, "Who are you?" He would say, "I am awake." Or he would say, "I am awakening," right? So I'm not talking about Siddhartha, who went through all the process of becoming the Buddha. I'm talking about the enlightened one. Who are you? I am awake. Buddh, B-U-D-H in Sanskrit is awake or to awaken. And so when we put it together and we use this term Buddha, it is the awakened one or the enlightened one. And if you asked Buddha what he had awakened to, he would say he had awakened to nirvana. And nirvana, the word nirvana is to extinguish. It's like to put out the flame of the old. So to be awake to nirvana means he was able to extinguish the false self so that misery can end. And I want to tell you something else. Often we Westerners who know a smidgen of Buddhism think that it has a lot to do with suffering and misery. And the thing is, we're missing the point if we believe that, because what the real message is that it is not wise nor is it compassionate to pretend that suffering doesn't exist. And so more than ever in June of 2017, more than ever before, we are called to be vulnerable, to feel in a very compassionate way all the things that have been stirring to awaken us to a greater truth of who we are. Beyond our credentials, beyond our titles, we can see that things seem to be in many ways breaking apart, not only in the country in terms of the former structures that used to serve us, but around the globe. And I think that's a fabulous thing, because even in the Old Testament, there were scriptures that said, the former things have passed away. And you know why the former things have to pass away? Maybe I shouldn't watch too much T.D. Jakes. You know, so I'm getting rather excited about all of this. The former things have to pass away so the new things can appear. And if we are an individualized expression, and that newness can only come through us, everyone on the planet right now, then we want to make ourselves available so that we can be relevant. We have to create space so that we can not do what we think is right, but what that higher and greater vision is. There is a spiritual truth that desires to emerge on this planet in June of 2017 and in July and in August. I'm not predicting anything here. And it can only come through us. Greatness is always revealed in the vulnerability. Never was there a great person or a great truth revealed in this planet that didn't come from someone who was willing to sit with the potential that was trying to emerge. We let go so that we can let come. because we don't know what it needs to look like, but we can open ourselves to be used by God in such a way that that expression of truth that is at a higher level than ever before can be delivered. Maybe not through us, but by the collectiveness of us being willing to be open. Remember that passage in the Course of Miracles? When you sit for a minute, when you sit in the stillness for a minute, 1,000 minds are touched. And so we know that Ernest Holmes, you hear me say this a lot, Ernest Holmes asked himself every day, especially those last 30 years of his life, every day he asked, God, who are you? He would say, who or what is God? He would say, what is my relationship to God? What is my relationship to the universe? And what is the purpose for my living? He would ask those questions every day. And I was intrigued to find this following quote in a Richard Rohr book. Richard Rohr wrote that the Franciscan priest, St. Francis of Assisi, you know him best from that prayer that all of us have said, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Lord, make me an instrument of your love, of your joy. Look what happens. Lord, make me an instrument of your goodness. There's an opening. There's an opening. And formerly you felt vulnerable. Now in this opening where you're calling on that power that is greater than you are, there is an act of courage. You can feel a strengthening in that way we make ourselves receptive to see what that is. This is the same posture that says, use me. Concerning the work of my hands, use me. And so we know that St. Francis said that great prayer, Lord, make me an instrument. But what is not as well known is that in the privacy of his cell at the monastery, the other monks recorded that he would chant these following words. Lord, who are you and who am I? Lord, who are you? And who am I? Lord, who are you? And who am I? Again and again and again. Why would these great sagey people, Holmes and St. Francis and so many others, what would move them, knowing that they were so confident in what they believed and how they presented it and taught it and how Ernest Holmes recorded it, what would move them? And I would say it's that which happens in the vulnerability of our willingness to sit still and to let God tell us how we are to express. How is it that I am an individualized expression of the divine? And so I want to end with this quote from Holmes from Anatomy of Healing Prayer, another favorite of mine. Holmes said, why are we here? Why? Why are we here? And then he says, I always liked Aurobindo's thought as he said, we are here for the delight of God. I have never anywhere heard a more beautiful expression of the mystical meaning of creation. Creation exists for the delight of God. Mm. Now, many of you have heard already that our beloved friend, Mike Armstrong, made his transition this week. And Rosie is here today, so we're going to love you up. I see they've already been loving you up a lot. And I wanted to say, first of all, I want to let you know that with the memorial service will be a celebration of life for Mike. And we will have that on Saturday, the 15th of July. So we have a couple weeks to get ready for that. And by the way, the family has requested Mike would appreciate a big potluck because he didn't get to eat much in those last few weeks. And so we're going to have a big potluck, so you're invited to participate in that, and we hope that you will come and we can have a great joy in honoring this amazing man. But I want to say that I think that Mike is someone we're all going to really miss. You know, I mean, I think it's the first time that I've been here in 6 years that someone, I will be doing a service for someone who was so well loved by the congregation. And I think the reason Mike was so well loved is that he was very comfortable with who he was. I would extend that to Rosie as well. I think that's where you were a good couple, Rosie, that you complimented that in each other. And what I know is that there is this gorgeous way that Mike left us a beautiful example that is so fitting with this discussion we have shared this morning. And so we celebrate Mike today, and then we'll do that in a formal way on the 15th. And in honor of Mike, I thought I would close by saying, let's find our own way of feeling comfortable with who we are. Because indeed, it is true, we are each a child of God. We are an individualized expression. Mike did that so beautifully too. And indeed, if it is true, as Aurobindo and as Ernest Holmes and so many others said, if it is true that we exist for the delight of God, then doggone it, let's give God a really good time. So take a breath. Let's just move this. Let's do a little transition into the sacred words of prayer so we can bless the movement of our friend Mike and we can anchor the meaning of the words of this message this morning. Just get comfortable where you're seated. Right where we are. Surrounded and held sweetly in these divine arms. The tender hands of God. And knowing that there is only one presence. It is the fullness of life. It is the power, the infinite intelligence of all the universe. It is God. And as we recognize that inner movement even now, the awakening of memory in the cells of our body that respond to the movement of life within us, the life divine, the love that is the pureness of spirit self. I feel the love of God in this room. I have felt it all morning. I can recognize it as an activity of goodness. And yet it is so powerful as a force in the universe. It is love that heals and mends and restores all relationships to that perfect essence of connection. So even when there appears to be a distance between oneself and the other, we know that there is no distance. For there is only God, and that God is right here, right now, that God is always present. There is no place where God is not. And so as we rejoice in this truth, as we recognize indeed it is a power for good, it is greater than we are, it is absolutely urging us, pressing upon us to be that individualized expression of life that we were born to be. Oh, I just feel so grateful. I feel the way in which that wisdom in our physical body is always curing and healing and shifting and changing so that we might experience the vitality and the vibrancy of truth, of life, of God, that indwelling presence. And today I especially understand that eternality of life that continues after the human body tires. That there is something so spectacular to know that life doesn't go anywhere. It's still right here. And so I rejoice in having this firmness of belief, of truth, this conviction for that necessity of life to continue, to know that the grace of God is continually pouring to us, streaming into our lives. And so I know that as I speak these words, that there is a healing going on, that there are physical ailments that are being reversed because the truth is presenting itself, that there is a wholeness in our being that desires to express with such aliveness that we are compelled by this virtual truth that is divine within us. And so I know that wherever there is limitation of any sort whatsoever, that as we align to this source, those limitations or blockages crumble to nothingness, and the fullness of the good we desire is now ours. And I say thank you, God. Thank you, life. Thank you, infinite spirit, for this wisdom, for this awakening of this day, restored to truth and aligned to possibility. And in that spirit of deep, deep gratitude, I simply release the words of this prayer into that divine law that can only respond affirmatively. I release it and let it be, and together we say,